This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. We are here every week at this time, and this is where we talk about the economy and your money. On today's program, I have a real estate specialist as well as a market analyst, Mr. Fabian Calvo, joining me. I'll get to that conversation in just a moment. And on next week's program, very excited to have Mr. Martin Wolf join me on the program. Many of you may recognize Mr. Wolf as the chief economic commentator for the Financial Times in London. I did have a conversation with him from his London office this past week. That'll be broadcast next week on the program. You'll want to stay tuned for that for sure. We have a couple of new retirement rules classes coming up. If you've not yet attended a new retirement rules class, let me tell you about it. It's a class where we talk about what's going on in the economy and what it might mean for you and your nest egg, and we discuss specific strategies that you might consider implementing in your portfolio to not only survive what we believe might be coming, but also to prosper. If you'd like more information on the class, all you have to do is go to the website, newretirementrules.com. The website is newretirementrules.com. We have a one-day class coming up on September the 27th. That will require you to do about an hour's worth of reading before you to come to the class. The three-night class begins on October the 7th and continues on the 14th and 21st. The cost for both classes, just $49 for you and a guest. That covers the cost of the book and all the handouts. Again, the website, if you'd like more information, is newretirementrules.com. I am pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Fabian Calvo. Fabian is one of the leading real estate mentoring and real estate investing experts in the world. He also has been an active political analyst and commentator, and he is a libertarian-leaning commentator as well. And Fabian, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Dennis. I appreciate it.
Fabian, we will have the listeners learn a little bit more about where they can learn more about your work. But let me first jump in and just talk a little bit about your background, because you have actually spent some time dabbling in participating in politics. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I basically have been a small business owner for the last 15 years, roughly, of my life. I run a real estate company that basically buys real estate in across the country, really. And in 2010, I basically, fed up with just the current political establishment as I was, decided to run for Florida House, the Florida State House. It was really an awakening process for me and really understanding. I mean, I think most people listening would say and agree, money runs politics. But when you're actually on the front lines of that, you really get a dose of it. And so, I kind of merge those two because I'm somebody who believes everything is pretty much connected in world events today. It all goes back to economics, and politics is clearly connected to economics. And so that's kind of the unique angle I like to approach the news of the day and also the historical events that we can tie back to.
So, Fabian, let's just get your take on what's going on now politically. We're approaching the midterm elections. There seems to be growing discontent with the status quo in politics. Do you see things changing significantly after the midterms, or how do you see this playing out, and how do you see this discontent among voters actually playing out?
I can look at other places in the world, and I could say that, you could see the discontent, for example, in Scotland and parts of Spain, throughout Europe with more nationalist parties that are working to opt out of the EU, and I could only hope that in America there's going to be that same type of backlash against the political establishment. And by that I mean the two-party system that clearly operates from the same playbook and clearly implements the same exact policies. For maybe a little bit of difference in rhetoric, there's really no difference between the two parties, and I think people are beginning to wake up to that. Now, through that awakening, though, it could mean that people just completely end up opting out of the political system. They're like, I'm not going to vote. It doesn't matter. And if that happens, well, the political elite end up winning. Unfortunately, like I said a little bit earlier, all things go back to economics. And we know that there is a, although there has been, incumbents that have been defeated by candidates with very little money, the bottom line is that money completely has saturated the political, just politics in general. And, you know, that's why, although there's a 6% congressional approval rating, you know, the majority, like the 95% of incumbents, keep getting reelected. And I don't think that's going to change unless there's some significant changes in the country, likely stemming from economic changes.
So give us your assessment, Fabian, on the U.S. economy presently.
Certainly. I mean, look, we are at the end of the road for the U.S. economy. And here's what I mean by that. It doesn't mean that, you know, the American worker may not still be the best worker. It doesn't mean that there's not all kinds of industry still left in America, all kinds of natural resources. But what I mean by that is the idea of the internet, the world, in essence, taking payments in a dollar, or in the dollar, being the world reserve currency, I really believe that's coming to an end. And we see all kinds of signs of this. We see the Chinese, the Russians, we see countries around the world, even the Europeans that are beginning to enter in bilateral trade agreements with other countries, bypassing the U.S. dollar. And that, I think, is the linchpin overall to the U.S. economy. Because when I talk about this end-of-the-road cycle for the U.S. economy, we look at the indicators and just look at the numbers. I mean, the Fed at this point must keep rates at 0% in order for there to be any type of growth whatsoever. Since the 1950s, credit expansion is close to $100 trillion. And the only way they can continue to keep the Ponzi scheme, what is what I refer to the U.S. economy as, is by printing more and more and more money. Well, you know, we're at a point now where the Fed has increased their balance sheets past $4 trillion since 2008 by printing money, lending it to the Treasury, unprecedented in U.S. history. Every other country, this is an important piece of information here, every other country that's tried this, it's failed miserably. And so that's where we're at with this. I don't think that they can keep it up much longer, although many thought they couldn't keep it up much longer since 2008. I think that's the biggest indicator for me is the devaluation of the U.S. dollar and the fact that any growth is inflation related, meaning the Fed has to continue to print money, credit must continue to be issued in order for there to be what they call growth. I would call that inflation, not really real economic growth. In fact, I'd argue that we haven't had any real economic growth in America for the last 5 years.
Well, certainly if you adjust the value of the Dow for the purchasing power of the dollar over the last 14 years, even though the markets are nominally up, certainly in real terms, arguably they're down a little bit. Let me ask you this, Fabian, because you mentioned that the dollar will lose its reserve status, and I think when one studies history, that's the conclusion you reach with any fiat currency that's ever existed. But I've had guests on the program that say the U.S. dollar will continue to get stronger, at least near term, because it's the best of a bunch of bad choices. What would you say to that?
Well, I mean, I think that theory, there's a lot of logic to that theory, and there's a lot of truth to that theory. I think what's left out of that are the revolutionary changes that are sweeping across the country. You know, 5-10 years ago, many people wouldn't have thought that the U.S. dollar would be devalued at the rate that it's been devalued with the QEs 1, 2, and 3 and 0% interest rates now for over 10 years or you know, if you average it out. No one would have thought of that. No one would have seen the Russian-Chinese alliance that is clearly on the rise. You know, we see on Monday these European sanctions that were levied against Russia. Well, Russia just turns around and basically goes to China, and now they've just increased their trade together, increased their energy deals. So I think these are things that a lot of people didn't, you know, many people did see coming, but many people don't take that into consideration when thinking that the dollar is going to continue to be the world reserve currency. The world is fundamentally changing. And we're beginning, I think, countries around the world, in Europe, in Asia, are beginning to realize that if they continue to buy into the dollar system, their countries are at the whim. I mean, take China. Inflation in China over the last 10 years has been up over 200%. I mean, that could spell full-blown revolution in that country where people are literally starving to death. Hundreds of millions of them are starving to death. And so they recognize they got to come up with a better system. And that's why you see the BRICS Union being formed. It's why you see their version of an IMF being formed and World Bank. It's why you see them putting together now an energy union that's going to challenge OPEC. And I wouldn't be surprised either, Dennis, to see in the not-too-distant future OPEC beginning to take payments for their oil in other than dollars. And so there's a lot of variables, a lot of things that I think are, I wouldn't necessarily call them black swans. I think they're just common sense economic moves by these other countries that are recognizing if they keep up with the dollar, it affects them and it hurts them economically. And I think those are not considered when people just have the knee jerk of saying, you know, the dollar will always be the best currency in the world. Well, look, historically, it doesn't work that way.
Well, our guest today is Mr. Fabian Calvo. Fascinating conversation. It's amazing how fast that time went. But the good news is we'll continue our conversation with Fabian when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. In this segment, I want to continue with the theme that we started last week, and that is really economics and finance in plain English. And I want to take a minute just to thank someone who brought to my attention that, you know, I can tell that you're talking about important topics on your program, but I'd like you to put it in maybe more layman's terms. So this is an effort to really just take some listener feedback and get you information that would be helpful and that you can use. So with that in mind, I want to take a moment and talk about what Fabian said in the last segment. And I really want to zero in on just a couple things that he said. The first thing that Mr. Calvo said is that any growth that the economy experienced or has experienced in the last 5 years has been inflation related. He also said that the biggest threat he sees to your savings, your nest egg, is that the U.S. dollar could lose reserve currency status. So I want to take this segment and focus on just those two things that Fabian said in the last segment and expand on those and provide you an explanation as to why you should be concerned about this. Why is this important? And let me start with the fact that Fabian said that any growth is inflation related. Well, what exactly does that mean? Well, to really come up with a good explanation, we have to define what is inflation. Inflation, technically defined, is an expansion of the money supply. Just means that there's more money that's created. Now, if you were to ask the average person walking down the street, can you define inflation for me? They would say, yeah, that means prices are going up. Well, increasing prices are really just a symptom of inflation. The technical definition is that you would expand the money supply. Now, expanding the money supply used to be a lot tougher than it is today. If you listen to last week's program, we talked about the fact that money used to be hard money. By hard money, I mean money was something tangible like gold or silver. And as time evolved, there was then paper certificates that would be redeemable for hard money. Well, in a system like that, where you can only print a certain amount of paper money, and the amount of paper money you can print is really limited by the amount of hard assets that you have in reserve, it's really difficult to expand the money supply significantly. However, now, as we talked about on last week's program, it's really easy. Every currency in the world today is a fiat currency, meaning it's currency by decree. And if you take a look at how the U.S. dollar has held up as far as buying power against other fiat currencies, one of the best indicators to look at is something called the U.S. dollar index. Now, the U.S. dollar index is a measure of the value of the U.S. dollar related to, or in relation to, I should say, the majority of its significant trading partners. So if you look at the U.S. dollar index, this was created in 1973, just 2 years after President Nixon eliminated the link between the U.S. dollar and gold, allowing the Federal Reserve to print money at will. Well, at that point, the value of the dollar started to float against other world currencies as well. When this index was invented in 1973, it had a base value of 100. So that means that a value of 120 would simply mean that the U.S. dollar experienced a 20% increase in value or purchasing power over the time frame. Well, if you look back at 2001, the U.S. dollar index had a value of 120. So that just simply meant that during that time frame from 1973 to 2000, point to point, the U.S. dollar gained about 20% in purchasing power. Today, however, 13 years after 2001, the U.S. dollar index has now rallied back to 84. That's a 30% decrease in purchasing power in the last 13 years. That's significant. So an item that cost $10 in 2001 would today cost about $13. Well, the stock market is priced in U.S. dollars. If you take a look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average, for example, in 2001, it had a value of about $11,000. Today, it's got a value of about $17,000. However, and it would have a value of $14,300 simply adjusting for the purchasing power of the dollar. So there's no doubt there's been currency devaluation. In fact, all you have to do is go to the grocery store to find evidence of this devaluation. Now, this devaluation is making a lot of foreign investors nervous. So, for example, if you take a look at what reserve currency is, basically the U.S. dollar is the most widely used reserve currency, and all that means is that countries are stockpiling U.S. dollars to use to buy stuff. So basically, if a country wants to buy oil or gold, the oil or gold is typically priced in U.S. dollars, so governments stockpile or store their wealth in dollars, just like you do. You store probably most of your wealth in U.S. dollars. Well, because of the devaluation of the U.S. dollar, a lot of these countries are getting nervous. And what they're doing, as Fabian said in the last segment, is they're coming up with other ways to do business so they don't have to use the dollar. Russia and India, for example, just put together a bilateral trade agreement. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that there's been some geopolitical tensions over what's going on in the Ukraine. Now, here's why this is important to you. If all these countries are keeping their wealth, their reserves in dollars, that helps Americans by keeping interest rates low. So since the U.S. dollar is most commonly used as a reserve currency, and there's a couple reasons for that, the U.S. Treasury market is both liquid and deep. And liquid means that the securities can be sold quickly. Deep means that you can sell a lot of U.S. treasuries without significantly affecting the price too much. If a country held their reserves in another currency that had a market that really wasn't liquid or deep, they might be able to sell a lot of these currencies, but it might move the price a lot, or they might have a hard time finding a buyer. So for that reason, the U.S. dollar is still used in the majority of international transactions. The euro is also used. The Japanese yen and British pound sterling are used to a great degree less. Now, here's the other requirement for a good reserve currency. If you're a country and you're holding your assets in a currency, you want to make sure that currency is unlikely to lose value to a great extent. And that's the tricky part. If there's credit downgrades, which there has been, if there's massive devaluation, which there has been, then if you're a country stockpiling your wealth in U.S. dollars largely to make trading easier, you're going to find other ways to trade. And that's what's going on around the world, and that's what Fabian talked about as well. So because the dollar is still the world reserve currency, interest rates are low, and imports are really affordable. If the dollar were to lose its reserve status, interest rates would go up. That would mean if you want to go borrow money, it's going to cost you more. And secondly, imports become more expensive. And because we don't manufacture much here in the United States anymore, the dollar losing reserve status would, by some accounts, reduce your standard of living by as much as 25%. And that was according to Sam Zell, who is a billionaire real estate developer. Now, that's one of the big issues when planning for retirement that you need to consider. That's something that your parents and grandparents didn't need to consider to such a great extent. We talk about this in our class, New Retirement Rules, and I want to remind you quickly that we've got a couple sessions coming up, a one-day session on September the 27th, a three-day session starting on October the 7th, continuing on the 14th and the 21st, You can get more information on the class by visiting newretirementrules.com. I'll continue my conversation with Mr. Fabian Calvo in the next segment. Stay with us.
Give me your money, honey. Just give me money.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I'm having a terrific conversation today with my guest, Mr. Fabian Calvo. And Fabian, great stuff in the last segment. If listeners want to learn more about your work, what would you have them do?
Yeah, well, for my economic and entrepreneurship geopolitic commentary, they can go to Fabian4Liberty.com. That's Fabian4Liberty.com. And for everything on my real estate company, basically, it's thenotehouse.us.
All right. Well, I encourage listeners to check that out. Fabian, we were talking in the last segment about the dollar losing reserve status. And for some of our listeners maybe who don't understand exactly what that means, could you explain what would losing reserve status actually mean? And then more importantly, maybe, what would be the consequences for our average listener out there trying to accumulate a nest egg and maybe retire someday?
It's a great question, Dennis. And this is what I mean by fundamental changes. And briefly, I'll just talk about how we've already seen fundamental changes happening. We'll see many more of them in industries. You know, take the record industry. It's completely transformed over just the last 10 years. Or take the cab industry with Uber, completely revolutionizing how that industry is working. And really, it's no difference with the U.S. dollar, which I believe is an outdated 20th century currency system. You know, now if basically you're Brazil, or, you know, if you're in Germany and you want to buy some tires, let's say, from Brazil, well, basically you need to take your euros, convert them to dollars, and use that as a means for global trade. It's the world reserve currency, which many of your listeners likely know. And what that does is it creates a tremendous amount of demand for the U.S. dollar, and that demand props up the value of the dollar, keeping prices of commodities and prices of things at Walmart and, you know, at the grocery store relatively inexpensive when compared to the rest of the world. Well, look, you know, in 1945, England lost its world reserve currency. No one would have ever thought that possible 10 years prior to that, but it happened. And, you know, now there's all kinds of the World Bank, many other top, you know, the Financial Times of London, all of them have been coming up with article after article how at the end of this year, the U.S. economy will be surpassed by the Chinese economy. And this is a real important point, Dennis, because England or the U.S. actually surpassed the U.S. actually surpassed England as the largest economy in the world in 1870. It took about 75 years for them to then have the world reserve currency. Well, today things move much, much faster. And so now we have China quickly becoming the number one economy of the world. How much longer will it take for that dollar to lose its world reserve currency? And when it does, you'll likely see prices for everything you shop for increase by double, maybe even triple. You know, no one knows because no one's ever lived through an economy as large as the U.S. losing its world reserve currency status. And that's why I would, you know, at least for me personally, I could only tell you what I do is I'm a proponent of gold and silver. I'm a proponent of hard assets like real estate, and really not, you know, the old adage of diversifying. Well, that's usually diversifying in dollar-denominated assets. I think we got to just think completely differently.
So, Fabian, give me your take on what happens when the Fed actually quits printing as we're recording this next month. One, is that going to be the catalyst that triggers a stock market decline? And I guess a second follow-up question to that would be, as soon as we do get an economic slowdown, what other strategy does the Fed have they can implement, and are they going to start printing again?
Yeah, well, I would. The Fed is still printing, and I don't necessarily buy into or believe any talk of a taper. I think instead what they've done is what we saw just late last year with basically, in essence, the Fed was laundering over $100 billion of T-bill purchases through Belgium. Basically, in the month of November, Belgium bought about 40% of its gross domestic product in treasuries. I mean, it's completely ridiculous. Most people don't get that, or it's kind of the smoke and mirrors. The point is that I think, you know, that the Fed will keep printing, and I also think that, you know, over the next couple of years, we're likely going to see the Dow Jones hit 20,000. We're going to see the real estate market go absolutely crazy. And when we do see the dollar lose, when we see what's often referred to as a dollar collapse, or I would call it a dollar shock, we'll likely see all of the bubbles simultaneously burst. Now, I personally believe, and based on my contacts, they believe this as well in Wall Street, that I think the Fed is already coordinating with other central banks around the world for this demise of the dollar. And whether or not the dollar ends up going into a basket of currencies as the world reserve currency, or whether it's the Chinese currency or some other currency out there, maybe the IMF SDR currency, that's not really a currency, but it can be used in payment systems. I mean, that's for anyone's guess. So, but I think that, at this end of the road life cycle, we continue to see markets like the Dow, like the real estate market, continue to dramatically go up higher before the big crash that I think is likely 3, 4, 5 years away.
Let me ask you, Fabian, because I've had guests on the program, and my study has led me to believe that I think there's a pretty good possibility that we see a deflationary cycle, given that private sector debt levels are at record highs. In fact, I think 50% higher than at the beginning of the Great Depression when measured as a percentage of the U.S. economy. What's your take on the possibility for deflation moving ahead versus maybe inflation, which sounds like you're maybe predicting, and how do you reconcile those two views?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I think that short term, we very likely, when the crash does happen, there'll be a panic. We could likely see deflation. It'll only give the Fed even more of a catalyst. And I think actually, to be completely honest, I think before we even have this economic shock to the U.S. economy, we're likely going to enter some kind of large war that will give the Fed and give central banks this legitimacy, if you will, to print even more money to fight whatever boogeyman enemy they've basically created. So I think that's actually where this ends up going. But look, when it comes to inflation, several months back we learned that central banks around the world pumped in $29 trillion into the global stock market, with more than half of that going into the Dow Jones. And so I just see this unprecedented amount of money creation and credit expansion like we've never seen before. And the only, again, the what's important for people to understand is that the only way they could keep with this infinite growth paradigm is by creating, expanding credit and printing more money. And, just as a student of history, Dennis, everywhere that I've seen this happen before, it ends in a currency destruction. And I think it's no different here.
So, Fabian, let's talk about real estate, since that's your specialty. We've seen a rebound in the real estate market. To what extent has this rebound in the real estate market been really linked to the fact that the Fed has kept interest rates low? I think the federal government is now directly or indirectly involved in 9 out of 10 new mortgages, and a big chunk of the money the Fed's been printing has been used to buy mortgage-backed securities. Is this real estate recovery fake in your mind also?
Totally fake. Totally manipulated. And here's where it stems from, is that when prices hit their lows in 2008, we saw Wall Street basically get 0% lines of credit in the billions of dollars to basically go out and buy real estate, distressed real estate, from Fannie Mae and from other lenders at record unprecedented rates, where today they're the largest landlord in America. And, I've been talking about this since the beginning of 2012. It's really what I come to call a pump and dump of the real estate market. Right now we're in this pump phase, and we see the big speculators on Wall Street, all the big billionaires on Wall Street. John Paulson owns one of the largest hedge funds in America. Recently him and another top hedge fund guy have invested $500 million into Realogy, who owns Century 21, Remax, Sotheby's International. Warren Buffett's company just bought Prudential, its real estate wing. So we see this pump of the market. We see this collusion between really the media, Wall Street, and in government to prop up prices. The media is already pumping up the real estate market, talking about how it's a great time to buy, take advantage of the low rates. All of this nonsense that we just saw 6 years ago is being repeated. Now, after the midterm elections, and we're already seeing this now, we're going to begin to see no money down loans come back roaring. I mean, look at, for example, GM car sales. As you may know, the audience may know, Dennis, they're basically 80% of their sales were subprime car loans. Anybody who walks on the lot, fogs up a mirror, drives away in basically a brand new GM car. Well, they're going to do the same thing with real estate. And I think this is all going to end, again, in this multi-bubble collapse of housing, of stocks, of bonds, of student debt. All of these bubbles are going to come to an end eventually. But again, at the end of this road of the economic cycle we're currently in, they're going to pump this up as much as they can. So after the midterm election, you're going to really see no money down loans take off.
So, Fabian, let's go back because you did allude to the media, and certainly I have my beliefs on the mainstream media, and it just seems to me that there's not really such thing as real news reporting anymore, and I know you have some opinions on that. Could you share them with the listeners?
Certainly. I mean, you know, look, we see CNBC's ratings at an all-time low. I think people are hopefully beginning to realize that the media are manipulators. You know, I don't have anything against, I'm a complete free market capitalist, but however, we have complete crony capitalism today, and it's ever present in the media complex, if you will. I mean, most of the media is controlled by about five corporations. It's a scripted, message that is being sent out, where basically we're in this economic recovery that, you know, they're in essence not telling the American people the truth about really anything, whether it's about what's happening in Ukraine with the Russians, whether it's what's happening in the Middle East with ISIS, and it's all just propaganda. And the truth is, you know, the average person out there that's, you know, focused on their job if they have one or on their kids or whatever it may be, they might watch 5 minutes or 10 minutes of news a day and, you know, look at what's dominating the headlines. Some NFL player that beat up his wife, which really, to me at least, seems like it happens every month, or, you know, Dancing with the Stars or whatever it may be. That's where people's attention is, and there's a reason why television is called programming. And I think that it's important for people to listen to shows like yours, Dennis, and others to really break out of that programming. You know, one of the things I wrote a book about the global economic reset that I released several months back, and as we were doing the research for it, it was interesting. We found that through all of these economic collapses that happened in the past or currency collapses, that, you know, about 60% of the population got totally wiped out. I mean, completely wiped out. And then there was the 1%, roughly 1% of 1% that, they, you know, it didn't matter what happens. They're going to do well. But there was about another 25% or so that actually did okay. They survived, and some of them actually prospered. And these weren't people that were rich or really wealthy. But what they did have going for them is that they were more awake as to what was happening. They were realistic, and they had expectations about where the economies were going, where world events were going. And I think this really classifies people that expose themselves to shows like yours, to different opinions out there about what the real state of the economy is, what the real state of the world is.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Fabian Calvo. And Fabian, we certainly appreciate you being with us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, Dennis.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen, and thanks again to my special guest today, Mr. Fabian Calvo, for joining us on the program. You know, I want to zero in again on a couple things Fabian discussed in the last segment. He talked about the fact that printing, money printing, that is, and easy money cause bubbles. In fact, Fabian said, and I certainly agree, that bubbles always burst, and he believes now that we're on a path where we're going to see a multi-bubble crash at some time in the future. In fact, Fabian said that, in his estimation, 3 to 5 years. Now, certainly picking the top of a bubble is very, very difficult. In fact, one of the most interesting comments on a bubble that I've ever heard was, I think, put forth by John Hussman, chair of Hussman Funds. And he said that bubbles have a way of making everybody look like an idiot. You look like an idiot because you get out too soon, or you look like an idiot because you stay in too long. Now, certainly I believe that Fabian's correct. In my view, certainly we are seeing multiple bubbles now that are building. and they're building as a result of the easy money policies that have been put in place by the Federal Reserve since 2008. And again, the easy money policies are simply the Fed has kept interest rates near zero since the financial crisis. Easy money abounds. In fact, as Fabian said in the last segment, he expects that no money down loans will come back. And certainly no money down loans in real estate contributed significantly to the last financial crisis. Fabian also pointed out that 80% of GM car borrowers are now borrowing money to buy cars, and they're all subprime borrowers. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means they're borrowers that don't have great credit. Well, in order for a bubble to exist, easy credit also has to exist. In order for a bubble to build, easy credit has to be available. It's got to be easy for folks to go out and borrow money. So bubbles are inflated by easy credit and easy money. Now, if you're skeptical that a bubble might exist presently, think about this statistic that Fabian gave us in the last segment. $29 trillion has moved from central banks to stock markets, with half of that going to the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That's easy money. And is that fueling a bubble? Well, in this segment, I want to talk about the characteristics of a bubble. And you hear the term bubble all the time, but what does that really mean? What does the term bubble mean when it's used in the terms of finance? Well, in its simplest form, a bubble refers to a situation where the price for an asset class exceeds its fundamental value by a large margin. So essentially, for a bubble to exist, you have to have market participants suspend their prior beliefs, suspend their prior valuation methodologies. So when a bubble exists, there's easy money available, and this easy money flows into the market because the market participants don't recognize that valuations are way out of whack. Now, if you think back to the tech stock bubble, many of you probably had money in the stock market in the mid to late 1990s. You could literally put money anywhere in the stock market and make money. And some of the tech stocks had valuations that were ridiculous. You had companies that weren't earning any profit selling for unbelievably high prices. In fact, we see the same thing again today. There's technology companies now trading for 700 times earnings. Well, those valuations typically don't exist long term. So when there's a bubble, not only is it fueled by easy money, but you have to have most market participants say, wait a minute, the prior rules don't apply. This is a new game. And all these folks typically, after the crash occurs, go back and in hindsight, because hindsight is 20/20, say, you know, that was a bubble. However, there's been a crash in the meantime. In fact, if you look at the housing bubble, we had banks that held subprime mortgages. They loaned money to people that, realistically speaking, weren't very creditworthy. They probably shouldn't have been borrowing the money in the first place. As a result, the 12 largest financial institutions in the world had lost half their value, and the real estate market, which had been red hot, collapsed. Same thing happened back, and many of you have heard of Dutch tulip mania. And this is probably the yardstick by which a lot of speculative bubbles are measured. There was a complete disconnect at the time between the fundamental value of a tulip and the price that folks were getting. In fact, over a 7-year time frame, professional growers in Holland became increasingly willing to pay higher prices for tulips. And tulips were selling for more than 10 times the annual income of a skilled craftsman. And in February of 1637, it all came tumbling down. The bubble crashed, and within months, tulips were selling for 1/100th of their peak prices. They lost 99% of their value. The stock market bubble that peaked in 1929 saw the Dow Jones Industrial Average lose 90% of its value. Arguably, Federal Reserve policies implemented in the late 19-teens, making reducing rather the backing of the U.S. dollar by gold by 40% down from 100%, had all this easy money flowing into the stock market. You could borrow money to buy stocks. You only had to maintain 10% equity in your account, and the bubble built, and the bubble subsequently burst. So when you look at bubbles, there's an economist who's not really a household name. His name was Hyman Minsky. He passed away in 1996. But he said any bubble cycle has five parts. There's first displacement. There's then a boom period. There's then euphoria. There's then profit-taking. And there's then a panic. And the first step, he said, is displacement. And displacement occurs when investors say the new rules don't apply anymore. They displace the old valuation rules, and they say, you know, this is a whole new game. That happened, as I said, in the 1990s with the technology stocks. This whole new internet technology is going to revolutionize things. We don't need to worry about earnings. We've got a whole new paradigm. We're going to displace, or the investors displaced the old valuation measures. Then, after prices start to rise slowly, they gain momentum. You enter a boom phase. Good example of a boom phase presently, corporate earnings went up about 3% or so last year, and the stock market went up 30%. That could be described as the boom phase of the bubble. There's then the euphoria phase. Asset prices skyrocket, and folks really don't pay attention to whatever the cost is, whatever the valuation is. They just want to get in before it's too late. In fact, if you go back and take a look at the real estate bubble in Japan that burst in 1989, land in Tokyo sold as much for $139,000 a square foot, or 350 times the value of Manhattan property. Bubbles do burst, and in Japan and the real estate market, they burst as well. Real estate lost about 80% of its value. Then there's profit taking. The smart money usually jumps out first. John Maynard Keynes, not my favorite economist, did have an interesting saying about how long markets can stay irrational. He said, markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. Then you enter the panic stage. Prices reverse, and they descend as rapidly as they ascend. Bubbles, when you chart price bubbles, tend to be symmetrical. Well, Fabian in the last segment said that what we have going on now in the stock market, the real estate market, and the U.S. dollar market is a pump and dump. Subprime mortgages are back. No money down mortgages are back. Subprime borrowers are borrowing money to buy cars with no money down. We believe that, as Fabian does, that we may be in a bubble, and we believe that we're in a bubble that may be unlike any other bubble we've seen in the past. We talk about this in our new retirement rules class. If you'd like to get more information on the class or register to attend, we do have two classes coming up. We have a one-day class beginning on September the 27th. We have a three-night class beginning on October the 7th, continuing on the 14th and the 21st. The cost for both classes, $49. You can get more information or register to attend either the one-day class or the three-night class by visiting the website, newretirementrules.com. The website again, newretirementrules.com. That's our program for this week. Thanks for listening.